This is Radio Ego Shock with Alex Smith.
If I feel a strain this week, it's not because of the volcano blowing planes out of the sky over Europe. Unless the larger Icelandic volcano nearby goes off, scientists say the dangerous ash will not really cool the planet much. It may damage our economy much more in the short run. But the biggest ever suspension of air travel reduced carbon emissions for a few days and taught a few people how to take a train or use video conferencing. Every cloud has a silver lining. No, my worry is about this week's program. All I have is an interview with a top scientist. Sounds less exciting than a volcano or Tiger's latest mistress expose. But wait, what if I told you half of the recent ice melt in the Arctic was not caused by extra greenhouse heat? What if rivers running dry and people dying by the millions all come from the same cause? Did you know there is fast warming and slow warming? That smog could be heating and hiding warming at the same time? So much that we could experience a permanent burst of heat taking us past the 2-degree safety mark in just a matter of days. Science can be way ahead of Hollywood when it comes to danger and mystery. Welcome to the Radio EcoShock special on black carbon. It is as evil as it sounds. Black carbon comes from incomplete combustion. It happens naturally from forest fires. Although some of the great fires lately are not so natural, warming has already shifted rainfall patterns and brought earlier dryness from Australia to California to Greece and Africa. A lot of black carbon comes from diesel engines, the highway trucks, public buses, construction equipment, generators, and trains. These particles are too small to see. Photo blow-ups reveal diesel carbon looking like tiny meteorites with rough surfaces and pockmarks. Those surfaces get coated with pesticides and other toxic chemicals, making it directly past our body defenses into our bloodstreams. You can find out more in my Radio EcoShock special for April 25th, 2008, Highway to Hell, How Smog Kills. Grab that free from our archives at ecoshock.org. The short story is low-level smog greatly raises the number of heart attacks. As Dr. Joel Schwartz of Harvard reveals, patients die quickly in their homes or on the streets, DOA, before they reach the hospital. And that happens all over the world, not to mention other breathing difficulties like asthma and emphysema. But black carbon haze goes much higher than our office towers. It floats up into the atmosphere, browning out the sun, over New England in the summer, over West Coast cities, over the whole of Pakistan and northern India, over much of China. And as we'll learn today, these dark particles absorb heat directly from the sun, helping to overheat the world. The haze also reduces the amount of sunlight reaching the earth, reducing our crops by as much as 10%, a huge loss of agricultural productivity. And when they land, most often collecting on mountains and in the Arctic, black carbon speeds up melting of snow and ice. That change of albedo adds to warming, and the abnormal runoff adds to both drought inland and rising seas everywhere. And strangest of all, we could probably fix the black carbon problem comparatively cheaply. But if we fix it too quick, the climate could suddenly turn on us, heating up the world. Damned if we do and damned if we don't. Welcome to the ironic universe. I'm Alex Smith. Let's find out about black carbon before it kills us. Later, we'll hear testimony to the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, chaired by Representative Ed Markey. One of the scientists called to testify was Tammy Bond, an expert in black carbon. Our guest is Tammy Bond. She's part of the Civil and Environmental Engineering faculty at the University of Illinois and affiliate professor in atmospheric science. She's an expert in what happens to our exhaust as humans burn millions of tons of fossil fuels. Dr. Bond, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
We call it the Blue Planet, but if human eyes could see it, we've made Earth kind of the dirty brown planet. What is the content of the sky like now compared to the time before machines?
Before machines, well, it is definitely what you might think of as dustier, darker, and also brighter, because the particles in the air that you can see from space reflect light back to space, and they also absorb light.
Well, I guess we could call it dust or dirt, but the right word is aerosols. Am I right in thinking there's sort of three types that we need to think about? There's the natural stuff like sand, there's a class of pollution that cools us a bit, like the sulfates, and then there's black carbon.
Yes, you have it just right. And there's also what you might consider natural black carbon from forest fires, and that was going on even before machines.
And I suppose that's a bit oversimplified because we also have the radioactive particles from atomic and coal plants and a whole range of toxic stuff like volatile organic carbons. Do these figure in climate change as well?
Of course. Pretty much anything that you can see is reflecting light or absorbing light. And the reason you can see it is because it's changing the way the light reaches your eye. And if it changes the way light reaches you, it also changes the way sunlight reaches the planet. So everything that is a particle will figure in climate change.
In March, you testified to the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. What was the focus of that morning session?
The committee was interested in, first of all, what was the role of the absorbing particles in climate change. In the climate community, they're called black carbon. You can think of it as soot, the black stuff that you see coming from the back of a diesel truck, or something that you might see from a candle when it's not burning well and flickering. So they were interested in that material. There's been some press lately about the fact that it does play a role in climate change. It absorbs light, it heats the atmosphere, and therefore it warms the atmosphere, not physically like CO2, but it's a similar impact. Humans put it out, it warms the atmosphere, and so we need to think about it a little bit.
How big a factor is it in warming?
Well, there's some disagreement about that now. I would say that it's smaller than CO2, but it's not negligible in comparison. So the lower estimates are about 0.2 watts per meter squared compared with CO2, which is about 1.6, and some of the higher estimates are about 0.9, so more than half of the warming of CO2.
And in the testimony, I heard about near-term fast global warming and then long-term slow global warming. What is that about?
So if we just contrast these two warmers, black carbon and CO2, which again is an oversimplification, if we contrast those, CO2 stays in the atmosphere for a very long time once you emit it, decades, 100 years, that kind of time frame. So once it's in the atmosphere, unless you do something drastic to get it out, it stays there. Particles come out of the atmosphere fairly quickly. They get rained out or they fall out. So their lifetimes are on the order of a week or 2 weeks. Now, what this means is that in a very long time, we're going to have a lot of CO2 to worry about and not very much black carbon. And CO2 is our real long-term problem on the order of decades. But what it also means is if you try to make a change in CO2, which people are attempting all the time, that will benefit us in the future, but it doesn't change the warming very quickly now. So if you want to quickly slow warming because you see that climate change might be proceeding a little faster than you had expected, one of the levers to do that is to remove black carbon from the atmosphere, because if you stop emitting it, it won't be in the atmosphere anymore after about 2 weeks, and then that warming is gone. I should add that the same is true of some gases, such as tropospheric ozone.
And can you talk to us a little bit more about the mechanics of black carbon warming? What actually happens?
It absorbs sunlight and turns it into heat. So most people are familiar with that phenomenon when they walk across a hot parking lot on a sunny day. You don't want to do that with bare feet because the black asphalt is doing the same thing that the black carbon does in the atmosphere. It is absorbing light and turning it into heat.
So it's actually warming the air itself, but then we also have this other factor. When the soot finally lands, it hits places like the Rocky Mountains, causing earlier spring melts, but the worst damage apparently happens in the Arctic, far away from our tailpipes and smokestacks. Why is that?
I don't know if I would call it the worst damage. The Arctic is a sensitive area that doesn't have any other sources, and so it is very sensitive, and when the soot lands on the snow, that's something that wasn't there before. especially in the spring, as the days start getting longer, it absorbs more sunlight, and instead of heating the air, it then heats the snow, and that causes melt. You get a double whammy from that, because after the snow melts, the surface beneath is darker than the snow by quite a lot, and so that absorbs additional light that wouldn't have been absorbed otherwise. Now, you mentioned that the Arctic was the worse than the Rockies or perhaps other snowy places. I don't know that I would call one of these worse than another. Those effects occur in the Arctic, in any snowy place, and in the Himalayas. So we're not quite sure what to call the worst.
Right, it's all bad. Well, another thing I'm hoping you'll help me straighten out, we hear about global dimming and masking and warming in the pipeline. Are these the same things or not?
Global dimming is attributable to aerosols to some extent. And so you may ask, well, if there's less light getting to the Earth, isn't that cooling? Yes, it is. And that has to do with what you spoke about before, which was the light-colored particles, sulfate particles, for example, versus black carbon. However, there's another thing that black carbon does. Any light that's absorbed and put into the atmosphere is not getting to the ground, so that even though the whole Earth system is warmed, the ground gets less energy. And when people were originally looking at global dimming, they were looking at the surface energy budget and how quickly water was evaporated. So even though black carbon warms, it also contributes to dimming at the surface.
Right. I've read about that in the work of V. Ramanathan at the Scripps Institution. He's been a pioneer in measuring that reduction of sunlight, and it's caused by giant atmospheric smog patches now called atmospheric brown clouds. Where are the biggest of those, and do we have any idea what the real impacts are?
Well, I think we have some idea of what the impacts are. More measurements are needed, of course, to get a good global sense, because when you make measurement, it's very often at a single place. And so extrapolating that single measurement to the globe is rather tricky because these aerosols aren't well mixed through the atmosphere, so they tend to concentrate around the emission regions. You asked another question, where are the big clouds? Is that a fair statement?
Yes, indeed.
What you were asking?
Yes.
Certainly they're around polluted areas. There are polluted areas with a high population. Those are everywhere in the world. Some big ones are the east coast of the United States, the east coast of Asia, around China, and South Asia. And then you get also clouds from open burning of forests and savannas, and those are in Africa and South America. So there isn't a continent that is missing a cloud.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Sunday night at 10:30 p.m. right here on Green 960 Online and Radio San Francisco.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about the soot in your air with expert Tammy Bond from the University of Illinois. Tammy, we've had Dr. Joel Schwartz here on Radio EcoShock, and he showed congressional staffers satellite photos of smudges of smog hovering over New England in the summertime. He says sudden cardiac death rates go way up when that happens. And now we've heard there are particulate domes over most of our cities. So we do have a very personal interest in cleaning up this kind of pollution, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And the health benefits have really driven a lot of reduction in particulate air pollution. The east coast of the United States used to be much worse than it is now, even in the early 20s. So there have been actions and regulations and a lot of success in cleaning up, and that's one of the promising things about tackling black carbon as a component of dealing with climate change. The fact that these are things that people want to do anyway will allow us to benefit health and air quality and climate at the same time.
On the other hand, I've heard both James Lovelock and James Hansen worry what would happen if we clean up air pollution too quickly. All the cooling effect could be lost and the temperature could shoot way up. Does that apply to black carbon?
No, it's the other way around, and it shouldn't be considered separately. We are doing all these actions. We are changing CO2 emissions. We are changing sulfate emissions. for health reasons, and that shouldn't be stopped just because it affects the climate negatively. And we are changing black carbon for health reasons, and that affects the climate positively. So if you remove black carbon, you get less warming and you get a health benefit. If you remove sulfates, it's true, you get more warming, but you also get a health benefit, partly because these regulations of the cooling particles are going quickly for health reasons. We also need to consider how we might counteract that reflection away from the Earth that we're losing by also reducing the absorbing particles.
Well, let's talk for a minute about diesel exhaust. The Europeans have more diesel cars, and they are sold as more fuel efficient, but the black soot these engines emit, we'll mainly hear from our trucking industry, it's deadly for us, for the ice world, as we've talked about, and for the climate. How big are the diesel particulate emissions when it comes to the climate itself?
Well, I can tell you that my estimates suggest that diesel particulate is about 25% of the global emissions of black carbon. So that's quite a lot. I don't want to give diesels a bad name. Mark Jacobson at Stanford has done some work showing that if you do have high black carbon emissions, that does counteract some of the fuel efficiency, and so you may not be benefiting climate as much as you possibly could. However, the diesel industry and the manufacturing industry has come up with some solutions that reduce the particulate emissions. And so I feel like the best answer is to use diesel when it's appropriate. We don't have many options for heavy trucks, for example, other than diesel. Use diesel when you need to, but then look really hard at the best control technology. Now, a lot of the global diesel emissions are occurring in places that don't yet have regulations. And that was true in the United States 20 or 30 years ago, and our diesels have cleaned up, and the diesels in Europe have cleaned up. So I think it's also a matter of taking what we know about how to do a successful cleanup, implementing the clean fuel that's required for end-of-pipe cleanup, and then implementing the end-of-pipe cleanup through regulation. And if we can do that, then diesel can still play a positive role in addressing climate change.
And we can also put in the diesel particulate filters. The City of London put 7,000 of them on all of their buses, and their transit system still works. But I guess one of the untold sources now is international shipping.
That's true. And actually, international shipping is a fairly small part of the black carbon budget. And so on a global basis, it's not a huge contributor. Where you might want to consider it is if it's emitted close enough to sensitive regions like the Arctic that it could deposit on the snow. And so that has to be very carefully looked at.
And I've read that about 25% of the black carbon is now coming from China and India, and it may even be from primitive sources like cooking stoves. What could we do there?
Well, my estimate, which is a bit uncertain, says that about 25% of the black carbon is coming from cooking or heating in residential applications. So it's not all China and India. We also use solid fuel in the United States. We do like our fireplaces and wood stoves. But what can we do? I think that there are very good reasons, health among them, to clean up household energy, and to give people access to clean energy. This isn't an easy task. People have been trying to do it for a long time for other reasons, not only health, but also to affect deforestation. And you have to do it very carefully, but there are some success stories. People like to have clean energy in their homes. They don't want to give up some of the things that they hold dear, and they don't want to change their practices so that they're inconvenient. But if we consider all those things and work with the people who are affected, who do see a benefit, then that can be a mode of progress as well. So although I think it's a tough thing to change, I think there's a lot of promise there, and it's one of the things that could help contribute to a lot of sustainable development. People talk about the Millennium Development Goals, and improving the lot of the poor people, and this is definitely one of the areas where we can make a difference. As well, we can benefit the climate at the same time. There aren't many opportunities to make such a big difference.
But some Americans ask, will an effort to clean up air pollution distract from tackling the bigger problem of CO2 emissions?
Well, I think that's a valid question, and I think we have a lot of environmental challenges. So I don't think we should say, let's run after black carbon and forget about CO2. Black carbon won't buy you very much in terms of the long-term CO2 picture. If you were to project emissions of both black carbon and CO2 for another 50 or 80 years, you would see that the forcing of the climate is dominated by CO2. What black carbon and other short-lived climate forcers can give us now is a little bit of time. We're not completely ready to tackle CO2. We're not able to make a rapid difference in the climate forcing. And so if we feel like we need to do that, then we tackle those pollutants now. But they can never replace CO2 and other greenhouse gas reductions, because those things build up in the atmosphere. And if we don't deal with them, they're still going to be there in 50 years, and we're going to have a large burden and a big climate change if we ignore that. There really isn't any time left to ignore the greenhouse gas problem.
Well, if we have to choose between cleaning up black carbon, which is good for us, or geoengineering putting mirrors out into space, I'll definitely go for the black carbon part of it. We're getting close to the end of the interview, but I wanted to ask you, at the Select Committee on Energy Independence, Representative Jay Inslee wanted to know, given how dire things are, why there aren't more activist scientists. What is your take on that?
Well, that's a good question. My take is you can be an activist or you can be a scientist. You can be a scientist who's a good communicator to activists, but you can't be both an activist and a scientist, because the scientific method requires an impartial evaluation.
Can you tell us a little bit about ongoing research? What do we need to know now?
Wow, we need to know everything about the Earth system, but I suppose you want me to focus on black carbon a little bit. So I think one of the things that we need to know is, how can we make a difference in household energy? I'm really excited about that opportunity. And so my group has worked with NGOs and people who are actually on the ground implementing stoves in order to give them tools to measure what's going on and to be a part of enabling that transition. So that's one thing we work on. We also look at future projections. If you think about everything that emits black carbon, it's probably closely related to personal decisions, consumer decisions, what people choose to do. And that's not very well reflected in the scientific take on how emissions will evolve. So that's very interesting to me, to understand how people's decisions interact with the climate system.
Is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Not that I can think of, but thanks very much for having me, and I hope that this gives people a sense of the broad array of challenges, but also solutions that we have as we face environmental problems in the coming decades.
Well, Dr. Tammy Bond, I know you've been crazy busy, so I really appreciate you squeezing in the time for our listeners. Our guest is from the University of Illinois, and she's an expert on our atmospheric exhaust.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@eagleshock.org. That's radio@eagleshock.org.